Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest edition of Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm excited to have a really great topic tonight and an all-star panel that I'm really excited to have engage on this topic. We've chosen to respond and just explore a little bit deeper the issues that were raised this past week by David Brooks, a famous New York Times columnist, who wrote a somewhat of a review essay for the Book of Mormon musical. It's called Creed or Chaos. It came out on Friday, April 21st, and you could go to New York Times and read it yourself, and we'll certainly try to at least frame it in some of the basic things that he says as we get going here. But to discuss it and the issues that it raises, I've got our favorite regular, Joanna Brooks. Joanna, would you like to say hi and let people know who you are for those who are listening for the first time?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thank you for listening. I'm a regular blogger at religiondispatches.org, and I also have a column at Feminist Mormon Housewives called Ask Mormon Girl.
And you had a great one this week where you responded to somebody about Book of Mormon historicity. I thought that was terrific.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then Joanna's also a lit professor at San Diego State University. Mm-hmm. So, good. We have the famous John DeLynn, the founder of the Mormon Matters podcast, Mormon Stories podcast, about 20 or 30 children of internet-type things. John, would you introduce yourself and what you're doing these days?
Sure. Thanks, Dan. Love your podcast, by the way.
Thanks.
So I'm currently in a PhD program studying clinical and counseling psychology at Utah State University. Married, father of four, and I hope to someday be a psychologist to people who are struggling with the nexus of mental health and religious issues. How's that?
That's great. That is terrific and certainly worthy. And you're the most well-known person in this whole group, for sure. And we're grateful to have you be able to join us again. And then our last guest is somebody who's also well-known to everyone, but this is his first time at least on the reincarnated version of Mormon Matters, and that is Brian Johnston. And he is joining us 2 time zones away from me, 3 away from Joanna, so he's the one who's staying up late tonight. We really appreciate that. So, Brian, would you tell us who you are and what you're doing?
Yeah, hey, everybody. My name is Brian Johnston. Let's see, what do? I help run StayLDS.com, work a lot with disaffected members of the church. I participate a lot of places on the internet, write some blog articles I have in the past. I've also done some Mormon Stories and Mormon Expression podcasts, and that's about me.
Yeah, and most recently, at least on Mormon Stories, was the 5-parter with Jared Anderson about the New Testament and also his spiritual journey, right?
Oh, yeah, really enjoyed producing that one. That was I'm very pleased with how that turned out.
Yeah, that was fantastic. I really learned a lot and enjoyed that, and kind of it started a friendship where Jared and I are now hanging out a bit, so it's fun.
Awesome. He's a great guy.
Yeah. Hey, well, thank you, you guys, for being on. You three are were naturals when it came for me to think of somebody to respond to this. For one thing, Joanna did respond on her Religion Dispatches blog, so I know she was familiar with it. But Brian and John, you work a lot with Mormons who, like you said, Brian, are disaffected or somewhat out of the box or exploring the nexus of faith, not necessarily and mental illness like John was saying there, but just faith issues and their regular lives, the scholarship different questions that they've come to. And David Brooks has really written a piece about religion and sort of the nexus between conservative religions that demand a lot of people, that have a rigorous theology, that have a real set of rituals, beliefs that tell people what is right, what is wrong, what is better, what is worse, how they should spend their time, sort of the best ways to act in the world, and a more fuzzier, maybe liberal, some would say progressive. There was actually a comment on one of the Mormon Matters podcast things where, Joanna, I think you and I were the guilty ones on this one, and somebody said that we were panelists who had we were unsalted. In other words, the salt had lost its savor. We were lukewarm. We were ready to be spewed out of the mouth because sort of the spirituality that this person felt like we were sort of pushing was sort of this non-doctrinaire, non-really rough-edged, or at least this is true, this is false sort of religion. And so that's what David Brooks's piece is about. Who read it, and anybody with just some initial thoughts on it, or should I spend a little more time framing exactly what he said?
I say frame it.
Okay, I just felt like I was talking too long.
No, here's some framing.
In his article, Creatorcast, he's basically talking about sitting in the audience and really watching this audience really enjoy the Book of Mormon musical. And he said he was enjoying it himself, said there's great production numbers, there was a lot of laughs. And yet, as he saw it and thought about it later, he said, you know, everyone in the audience was liking this because the message was, yeah, religions can be kooky. Yeah, they can have these beliefs, but deep down, you know, underneath it all, everybody believes in service. Everybody, you know, people should practice their love. You know, they preach love, they preach service, and as long as people are doing that and are tolerant of other beliefs, that's okay. And he said that was the message that they were doing, and yet he's saying there's no way that missionaries go across the world to Africa that come out of these generic, you know, namby-pamby, all is love, all is service sort of non-rough-edged religions, non-rigorous religions. And so he says, you know, the very power that made everybody in the audience excited for the message is not the power that actually moves people to get off their butts to serve and to do things like that. So he says, the problem with the Book of Mormon musical is that its theme is not quite true. Vague, uplifting, non-doctrinal religiosity doesn't actually last. The religions that grow, sucker, and motivate people to perform heroic acts of service are usually theologically rigorous, arduous in practice, and definite in their convictions about what is true and false. So that's sort of the tension that he's bringing up, and then he goes on to talk about all the different things that rigorous theology and rigorous practice and all those things do, and he just doesn't believe that the religions that don't ask a lot of their people are really the ones that make people stand up and do things. So is that a decent framing? Anybody want to add another layer or two to that?
That's about it.
Sounds good. I'm endorse the summary.
Okay. Brian, yeah, were there good. Okay, so that's basically it. We could certainly go, you know, into all of he's got what, 5 or 6 paragraphs that begin with the words rigorous theology provides this map of reality. It allows believers to examine the world this way. It helps people avoid mindless conformity. You know, he does all that, and so people can go and get a little piece there. So, all right, so those are his points. John, you are the only one of us panelists who've seen the musical. Before we even begin to talk about the merit of his claims, has he got the Book of Mormon musical right? Was the message that he saw as being promoted by Trey Parker and Matt Stone and the musical, was it this vague spirituality versus something more rigorous?
I think he got it half right. For me, there were two takeaways from the musical. First of all, the musical was fabulous. I was in tears at several points. It got my Mormon experience more accurately than I probably could have penned myself if I had written a Broadway musical. I mean, he nailed things that I would have never expected anyone, including LDS people, to have nailed, including my mission experience in Guatemala and what it was like to serve there. And you know, a lot of the struggles of the nuances of the doctrine and theology and the crisis of faith stuff, along with the virtues and the beauties of Mormonism. One of the most beautiful scenes that I've ever seen on Broadway was the scene when like 8 villagers within the village get baptized. They mm-hmm. treat it very reverently, very warmly. Mm-hmm. You feel, quote, the spirit of, about as strong as you could ever. And they get just sort of missionaries and missionary work and what it's like down to the, you know, mission president who's angry and punishing, which was the way my mission president was sometimes. I mean, he got so mm-hmm. much, they got so much right. So, but the two main points that I took away are, and these have been has shared a lot on the Blogger Knuckle. One is that this is what I took away. What he got half right was that religions make people do good things, and I would add sometimes silly things, but by and large, there was this clear message that Mormons are good, wholesome, sincere, mm-hmm. loving, honest, kind, hardworking people, and he got that right. The assertion that I did not see at all in the musical was that they were making a commentary on what religion should do or shouldn't do, what they should be, what is the most effective thing for a religion to do. I didn't get that sense at all. What I sensed that they were trying to communicate is that religions are not intellectually credible. And so there's a series of musical numbers that talk about what the church believes and doesn't believe and what their history is. And I think the only commentary they were making there was this story is not credible to someone who's willing to look at it objectively with a scientific worldview, with an intellectual worldview. I did not get a sense at all that they were saying all religions should be metaphorical, all religions should dumb themselves down and weaken themselves. I just don't see them as even seeing themselves as it being appropriate for them to tell religions how to be and how not to be. I wouldn't see them as even being interested in making that type of recommendation. So that guts for me a lot of the points he was trying to make, because mm-hmm. I didn't see them trying to make those points personally.
So not even at a meta level where he could say afterwards, you know, I could see that this is the popular religion with the kind of crowd that would go to a Broadway musical. They're, you know, peace, love, tolerance, you know, practice. Yeah, go ahead. These are nice as long as they're metaphorical and not literal and all that stuff. You don't think he's sort of nailed it that of course their response would be super strong to this because that's sort of the religion that they think every religion should be like?
Well, I think that, and I don't want to dominate here. I think that his observations on what historically has made some religions last longer or grow faster or be more strong or resilient, I think those observations are correct. But I don't think he was telling religions to tell all their believers that all the beliefs are metaphorical. And I don't think he was telling I don't think they were telling believers that they needed to convert their beliefs to be metaphorical. Now, there may be some lines that kind of suggest that, but I just don't see them trying to – I think they're trying to do satire. I think they're trying to have fun. I think that the audience that they're sort of pointing to is the South Park younger, hip audience that likes a little bit of irreverence and that likes satire and that likes biting social satire. And I just don't see them as trying to be preachy or make suggestions.
Okay, cool. So in other words, if Brooks has his points, he wasn't really jumping off the Book of Mormon musical. He was probably seeing a little bit of that and then just deciding to write his column to make the points he wanted to make.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe.
Joanna or Brian?
Well, I mean, one thing that strikes me immediately, and, you know, I haven't seen musical, but I've been following the press on it really closely, and lots of reviews from lots of Mormons of all stripes who have seen it, is that David Brooks's piece, I'm afraid, I mean, I know the Book of Mormon musical is a critique of literalism, right? I mean, there's that famous scene, John, maybe you can narrate it, where, who is it? It's Moroni and Darth Vader and Frodo Baggins. Who's up there at the same time in that tableau?
Yeah, it's well, are you talking about the one with not, you're not, okay, you're talking about the one, yeah, it's like Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and you know, there, I guess there's this whole sub-narrative, which I think is brilliant, where the missionary discovers that the Book of Mormon messages, you know, things like, and the Lord cursed their skin to be dark because of their wickedness, kind of wasn't really helping the African people. And because he had a penchant to be dishonest, and this is a bit of a spoiler, he decided to inject relevant narrative into his recounting of Book of Mormon stories, so that the villagers would see them as being relevant. So he invents all these narratives about AIDS and about malaria and about female genital mutilation, you know, and even intermixes Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and the Book of Mormon into the mix, so that he could make it relevant. And I got a sense from that they were saying, and then I want you to join in to finish what you're saying. What they were saying is that it's you know, it ends up being these stories that are transformative in people's right. lives.
Yeah. Right. Stories are powerful, right?
Yeah.
And David Brooks, no relation, of course, keeps hitting the idea that only rigorous theology will keep people in. Only rigorous theology will keep people in. And I'm afraid he's conflated literal approaches to belief, right? Literalist takes of theology, literalist takes of the Book of Mormon with rigorous theology. And those are not the same thing. To be a literal believer is not necessarily to be a rigorous theologian.
Interesting.
And Andrew Sullivan, in his column, had a very interesting response, arguing that literal and fundamental approaches to belief are, in fact, the opposite of rigor, and that they levy a tremendous spiritual cost. So, you know, I mean, I totally got the gist of David Brooks's column about what gives a religion traction. What really gives it traction? What really motivates in people's lives? And understanding the musical as a critique of a simplistic literalist approach, you know, to belief, to questions of, for example, Book of Mormon historicity. I think he did wrong by conflating rigorous with literalist.
Yeah, actually, that was my big problem with the article too. I kept finding myself confused reading through his arguments where he kept saying the word rigorous theology.
Right.
And like you said, conflating that with literalism, and I've got this one sentence that he says, rigorous theology helps people avoid mindless conformity. He's like cheering for this intellectual depth and questioning, but, I mean, that's what rigorous, you know, if you believe in it literally, then there has to be a mindless conformity. You know, there is only one way to see it if it's literal.
Right, and you guys, I think, are focusing far more on the theology word than I was. I just felt like he was saying rigorous religion, demanding religion, religion that, you know, costs. It's the Joseph Smith or the Lectures on Faith line, that a religion that doesn't right. require the great sacrifice doesn't have the power to save its people. I was throwing in ritual and, you know, myth and stuff, and not just systematic theology or creedalism and sort of the things that you focused on in your Religion Dispatches piece, Joanna.
See, but what is interesting is he sets up that very provocative binary in the framework of the article and calling it creed or chaos, right? I mean, mm-hmm. he sets up this black and white thinking that maps right onto those literalistic views, right? It's either you take it hard and take it strong, or it's nothing, it's chaos, which is a bit of a dumbing down of his own article, but that's the trajectory he pushes us on, and that's where I wanted to push back.
Yeah, and I mean, he's borrowing that from Dorothy Sayers. He says that's Christianity's advantage, that it gives value to evil and suffering. It's the one that asserts perfection is attained throughout the active and positive effort to wrench real good out of real evil. This was his. That's where he got the creed and chaos was from her. Yeah, I don't. You wonder sometimes. Do they even give their own headlines? Did he name this his editorial himself? But again, I didn't really quite focus on creedalism and literal belief the way you guys have. The way Andrew Sullivan, I had read that piece too, did as well. I guess I'm just sort of the. The high-cost religions are the ones that really would cause somebody to fly around the world and try to serve another group.
Or fly a plane into a building.
Good. I want to get into. Yeah. I want to get into the shadow side. So yes. So it sounds
wait,
like.
Wait, just one more comment. Just
yeah,
let me
please,
let the English professor out. I mean, you know, as John was talking about it, I was thinking, You know, the Book of Mormon musical was not a documentary expose of how false Mormonism is. And this is not to say I think Mormonism is false. That statement itself is meaningless. But it was a play. It's a genre that encourages us to suspend our disbelief and give ourselves over to this world and enjoy it. And so, you know, I think that the musical itself encouraged us all to delight in storytelling and in the good it can move us to just by virtue of its genre. So I think that's worth considering.
Sure.
Okay. English professor's back in the box.
we like the English professor. I do want to get into the sort of the shadow side, but it sounds like none of you quite had as positive a view of David Brooks as I did, as far as at least I think he nailed something fundamentally important. It seems like you all are nodding in that direction, but so I guess it's easier for me to say what are the shadow sides
of all
the positives that he's saying.
Can I jump in?
Go ahead, please.
I think that he definitely does a decent job describing, as Joanna said, what makes a religion hearty or vigorous or have traction. But for me, he's describing what he sees, and he's describing what may even be factual or accurate in some areas. But when somebody decides that they need to make a religion metaphorical to be able to keep it, or when somebody decides that they need to loosen their commitment to a religion or even abandon it, it's a serious endeavor that's born usually out of a deep love and a conviction for the religion that they once held most dear. And so I don't know how helpful it is for him to be saying, well, if you want real religion, pick a vigorous one. Because I think that if people could just simply choose it, and if religions could just will that everybody obey blindly, you know, that would be wonderful maybe. But it's just not the reality of what religiosity in the 21st century is.
Yeah.
You know, Joanna's been educating me a little bit about Reform Judaism as a movement. And if you look in the late 1800s, you see this, what is it, the Pittsburgh Declaration, Joanna?
Pittsburgh Platform
that comes out where they're saying all these things that I'm not realizing or that Mormonism isn't really grappling with until 2005, 2010. Things like, you know, maybe we don't have the one true path. Maybe our scriptures aren't historical. Maybe we have a lot to learn from other paths as well. You know, maybe we do need to take things metaphorically. You know, all that stuff is born out of the clash between science and religion, doctrine and theology and reality. And so, you know, on the one hand, yeah, he's describing something that's real. On the other hand, he's missing the point of why people need to move to symbolic or metaphorical interpretations and why people soften their religion. And they do that for substantive reasons that are credible and that deserve respect. And it's almost like putting blinders on to say, we need to all be literalistic. Religions need to be absolute, because it's denying 21st century reality, in my opinion.
Okay, really good. Now, John, you have actually sent us, you've framed the two main areas I wanted to go into. First of all the positives that David Brooks says, I wanted to talk about the shadow side. So you mentioned the flying into planes. So I think I still want to take that one on first. But what you've just said sets up really well for the thing after that, which is with you guys and all of your experience dealing with Latter-day Saints who are moving in the directions that you're saying and are troubled by the issues you're bringing up, John, I wanted to then engage David Brooks just the way you've begun that conversation. So are you okay to table that for just now?
Yeah, of course. Thank you very much.
You've intuited at least the two main sort of areas that I wanted to go into. So if you guys are all right, let's go back quickly. So David makes some good points. I think all of us would probably say, at least to some degree, yes, having good, solid moral teachings can be a very big positive in the world. Yes, ritual. Like, for instance, I like his line in his there. It says, a Mormon denying herself coffee may seem like a silly thing, but regular acts of discipline can lay the foundation for extraordinary acts of self-control when it counts the most. So I think a lot of us would agree that there are very positive things about all the different things he was saying in there, even sort of the mindless, keeping you from mindless conformity thing that you were talking about, Brian. He's making a point there that, that you know, if theology is going to at least cause you to wrestle and to not just be a sponge about what was out there in the world, right?
Yeah, I got
you. Okay, so we see all these positive things. So what are the shadow things to these to religion? And I guess my bigger question is when the misfire, when the good things that Mormonism has, these rigorous things, when the misfire happens for people, is it happening because these things themselves are problematic, or is it happening because of the unskillful ways that the message is presented? The unskillful messengers who happen to be your gospel doctrine teacher or your stake president or somebody or just, you know, your neighbor being unskillful and basically telling you this is the one and only way to be a Mormon or something. So I want to kind of get into that. So did I strike a nerve where somebody wants to jump in?
I'm dying to, but I've talked too much. So I'll let Joanna start, or Brian.
Brian.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I would throw in there, I think one problem, or the dark side of this rigorous theology that he's trying to promote, where there's an answer to everything and the religion has the answers. And actually, I really feel that that's an important part of functional religions, is that they should model and describe the world and give you tools to navigate relationships and moral values.
Yeah.
Now, what the problem that happens for a lot of people is, not a lot of people, for some people, the ones that have issues with that, that want to switch to the metaphorical, is their life experience, the model that they've given fails too often. Like, it fails them. And that's why it starts to break down, and they need to somehow either shift that or find a new worldview that explains everything. And actually, I thought of a great example. I just happened to have been in Lancaster, Pennsylvania this weekend, which is the home of the Amish. Now, right. if there's a group with more rigorous David Brooks theology than them, I'm not sure I know. But now, the interesting thing was, I was visiting a friend, and they're totally non-religious, but we went out to go on this carriage ride that the Amish put out. You know, it's like a little tourist thing. So you get in the back of this carriage, and somebody rides you around town. But the interesting thing was, the carriage driver was a young man who was just wearing like a t-shirt and jeans and everything. And he's like, you can ask me anything you want about the Amish. So we're talking to him, and you come to find out that he's a disaffected Amish. I would guess he's like 20 years old. Yeah. And this was the interesting thing, as I was listening to him talk, was he described how wonderful it was growing up on the farm and working hard, but he just was totally not satisfied with that lifestyle. And he wanted, like, one of the rules that was big for him is you can only go to the 8th grade in school. And after right. that, you have to stop going to school. Well, he wants to be a veterinarian and work with animals. So he's not going to be able, for them as an adult, you have to consciously join the church. So he's not going to join the church. But then he was talking about, you know, how he really wants to come back. He wants to be in that community, but be a veterinarian and have a college degree and all that stuff. And so that worldview was totally failing for him, but he still had that longing, like he wanted to ride a carriage around town and be around horses and marry an Amish girl and all that stuff. So it was just a fascinating thing to watch.
I mean, I think, Brian, what you're saying points to one of the areas where the kind of rigorous, for lack of a better word, what David Brooks would call a rigorous or demanding faith really can misfire, is that Brooks totally underestimates the deep pull and the hunger to belong that people who grow up in a religion experience. And, you know, the dark side of this sort of rigorous creedal faith is, you know, when ritual professions of allegiance, right, to this static creedal faith take priority over social relationships, take priority over this feeling that you can continue to belong. I mean, this is something we know in Mormonism, right? Your belonging can be, if you're in a very Orthodox context, predicated on not growing and not changing, you know, so you need to get up every day and say, I know the church is true, and have that be fixed and static. And if you start to have growth or change or experiences that make you reexamine that, or even if the church itself, some of the doctrines of the church as you mature into them are just uninhabitable, like some of the rigidly conservative gender doctrines or anti-gay doctrines are just impossible, you are going to lose a social universe. You might lose a spouse. You might lose parents or siblings. Some people might lose their employment. You lose this whole community, right? So that's, for me, one of the major, major downsides or dark sides of a rigorously creedal focused faith that really insists on you have to kind of recite your allegiance to the creed at all times. And that's something I know a lot of people who listen to this podcast have experienced.
Yeah,
very interesting. Good points. Brian, you're actually just the example of the Amish was interesting to me, and it sort of relates to John's questions pointing us to move on, what we'll move on to soon. And that is the Amish, the way that they manage that is by closing themselves off from the world, by being, you know, very insulated and whatnot. And it's until the kids turn 16 and they go have that, I can't remember what it's called. I did see that documentary that was fascinating. But until the kids go out to the world themselves and then come back and decide to choose it or not, it's insulated from the outside world. It's insulated from science. It's insulated from challenges, really as much as you can, keeping them apart. So in some ways, that is a strategy. Isolation can work, and like say the positive is this longing for community and whatnot. But I just thought I'd make that point about isolationist strategy versus more of an integrationist one.
Yeah.
Hey Dan,
please.
When you were setting up this discussion, this part of the discussion, did I want to make sure I don't respond to something you didn't say? Did you say that is it possible that what spoils religion for people are misinformed but well-intended Sunday school teachers? Was that kind of the essence of your question?
Well, for me, you guys all know that I have a pretty Mormonism feels big and roomy to me because I do sort of anybody that tells me it's literally this or literally that, or anybody that wants to say all or nothing kind of things to me, I've read enough. I've prayed enough. I've had spiritual experiences enough to where I know that stuff isn't true, and so it doesn't bother me.
Right.
I mean?
Okay.
I'm sort of beyond. So I'm just saying, why is it that some people experience Mormonism big and broad the way maybe I do, and maybe some of us here do, and others see it very narrowly? And so I'm wondering if it's the messengers, if it's the parent, if it's the bishop, if it's somebody like that that's really driving them down that path, rather than Mormonism itself, rather than the fact that there's a rigorous theology to begin with.
Okay. And so I did prepare an answer for that. And I'll illustrate my answer with something that happened over the past couple of days on the internet. I'm aware of an LDS bishop from the UK who recently started studying church history, church doctrine, church theology, and became so burdened by the cognitive dissonance and the confusion and the disappointment of what he discovered through his studies that he actually had to resign as a bishop while he was serving as bishop. And he was gracious enough to post both his final talk he gave in a sacrament meeting about how we need to love those who have become disaffected, and then he posted his resignation letter as bishop, and without much delay at all, our good friend Michael Ash from Fair and Farms and Shaken Faith Syndrome appears on this gentleman's blog and basically says, you sir are, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically says, you sir are lazy, you're a black and white fundamentalist thinker. It's fundamentalist thinkers like you that have been that are the destruction, that are the bane of society. And if only people would learn that it's not about black and white, and it's not about true and false. It's about finding the gray and the nuance. The deep and rich religion is all about. If only you could learn that lesson, you could be as enlightened as me. And it wasn't two posts later that somebody then puts up quotes from Gordon B. Hinckley, from Thomas S. Monson, from the church's own top leaders, prophets, seers, and revelators, who have, as you well know, Dan, are very famous in saying things like, the church is, you know, the Book of Mormon is either everything it claims to be, or it's the greatest fraud that's ever been perpetrated on mankind. And I could list for you 1,000 scriptures from top prophets, seers, and revelators who have drawn lines in the sand that are very much true, false, black, white, binary thinking. So I think that those of us who succumb to that, I being one, come by it very honestly by people who claim to be special messengers for God. But I will take it even one step further, Dan, and that's to say that it's the scriptures that end up being the most condemning for the people who struggle in the faith. You don't have to look any further than, you know, the New Testament that says, I would that ye be either hot or cold, for if you are lukewarm, I shall spew thee out of my mouth. And you look at the genocides and you know, God sending bears to kill teenagers if they mock the prophet. And if somebody touches the Ark of the Covenant, they die. Right. And, you know, you don't have to look very hard in the scriptures to realize that it's the scriptures, it's the doctrine, the theology itself that is encouraging this thinking. Now, it also encourages other types of thinking. But in the end, you know, people who want to take something seriously aren't going to gravitate to the nuance.
But, John, so, I would – go ahead, sorry.
No. So I'm just saying sort of – I wouldn't – I think you're blaming the victim if you blame people for taking a true-false binary mindset. I think it. Mm-hmm. I think the responsibility and the accountability goes straight to God if you're going to put the blame on somebody.
Wow.
John, I would question whether or not, I mean, you, if I understand you right, you're citing the evidence that people use to compel more literalist, more whole cloth approaches to Mormonism as evidence that this kind of binaristic in and out is actually intrinsic to the Mormon tradition. Is that right?
Well, I think both the scriptures and the Mormon tradition have everything in it. It has literalism.
Right.
It has broad-minded expansiveness. It has it all.
Because my hunch is, I mean, and I just tend to see things as being profoundly socially motivated. That was my main critique of Brooks' article. And that's the way I tend to view Mormonism as a whole, is that these strategic and timely deployments of mandates to think, you know, literal, believe whole cloth Mormonism have these social functions, right? They're deployed strategically at pivotal historical moments in the life of the community to patrol social boundaries as much as they reflect any right core. And so I think we're on the same page. It's just, I want to claim some space in Mormonism, like Dan says, for, you know, roominess, while acknowledging that there are times that, you know, everyone from the people you attend church with to your family to people in more power than that, you know, deploy hardline thinking to bring people back into line for social purposes.
Sure. And let me just make sure you understand, Dan, and I'd love your response. I am not saying that Christ doesn't lay out room for nuance, or that Joseph Smith wasn't one of the most expansive minds that we see in 19th century American religious thought. I concede all of that. What I'm saying is, to blame the Sunday school teacher is about 5 levels removed from the source of fundamentalism, you know, which is God and the scriptures themselves, even though they also leave room for non-fundamentalism. Mm. That's all I'm trying to say.
Okay. So, well, yeah.
Blame God.
I'm saying don't blame the Sunday school teacher is all that.
No, and I don't think I was really saying blame. I was just saying, is the problem in the lack of skill, or is it in rigor itself? I was really just going with rigor itself versus people who are conveying that this is the way to do it. You know, the one and only true way. So you've raised a lot of things. You and I kind of covered some of that ground in the podcast interview you did with me. So
sure.
I don't want to go too
That's fine.
Too much further. But I mean, the world is different to people who I mean, blame the victim was difficult words for you to hear, for me to hear, because I don't think that's what I'm trying to do. But I would want to assert from the basis of you know, developmental theory, even like childhood development, that the world is different for the child because of their brain hasn't developed as much as it is for the adult, right? They cannot separate the symbol from what it symbolizes. Mm-hmm. You know, they have magical thinking and whatnot at certain things. And at a certain point in adulthood, you have all that abilities, but then some people haven't been exposed to, for instance, to deconstruction of scripture at all. There is no sense that somehow scripture, you know, is just this sort of accepted stuff that has this status because of thousands of years of people saying this is special. At some point in a person's life, and it's not a blame or way to go, you're advanced versus you're behind. Just your experiences have you meet scripture at different levels. And so I'm trying to not make this blame or advanced or whatnot. It's just your experience of life is differently. So where you see God behind these scriptures, you know, and God's the one to blame rather than the person who's interpreting it five steps removed from that, I don't see God to blame for those scriptures at all. I just see that people were people back then, and these scriptures were created, and I don't see them somehow skipping the steps that the revelation I would receive today, which is very colored from my personality, from my expectations, from the hopes, from my looking for explanations and reasons. I just don't see, you know, go up thou bald head and, you know, have the bears come out is anything to do with God. You know what I mean? It's in the scripture.
Sure. Can I just add something?
That way. Yeah, please.
I like to make fun of the prophets and make fun of God, and those bears are no joke, man. But if you just run, fast enough, you can usually get away from them.
Or you have to only be faster than the slowest guy running away from
them. Right? Dan, I have a question for you, Dan, because
please.
You know, I like your vision, and I know the church is a really comfortable, you know, mostly comfortable place for you, right?
Every once in a while it gets really crazy, but it's usually more like, oh, we missed an opportunity to really go deep on something really cool here. We stayed in first grade, you know, so that's kind of the frustrations I get.
And you yourself admit that it took, you know, a lot of reading, and you did some like dedicated professional study basically
to get you to
that point.
No kidding. Yeah, no kidding.
And so what social resources or social support are there for everyday Mormons who are trying to create that more insulated, self-confident sense that allows them to continue to inhabit, you know, mainstream institutional Mormonism? Did you do it by yourself? You know, kind of support did you have in making this transition?
I mean, I did do a doctorate in religion, so I certainly was exposed to people, not necessarily always Mormons, but people going through this same journey with theirs, and professors who had been through this journey, and, you know, we had Burton Mack, who, you know, is this extreme New Testament scholar who's just so wonderful and lovely a person, and he's going, I know I'm screwing with your minds, you know, and good thing you can go down the hall and talk to John Cobb. and undo the damage that I'm doing. And so there was this gentle way to do it. And you're right. It's
right.
Very
so
difficult.
For a few
and
that's
why podcasts.
Right. And so for a few years, you had a dedicated social community that was supportive of you in your transition. And I realized today I did my transition. I mean, I was less active for, I don't know, 5-6 years. And I did a lot of it alone. And mostly I just cried.
Oh, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, it's okay, John. But I mean, I'm just thinking, like, so for everyday Mormons who are, you know, trying to transition, who aren't in graduate school, right?
Absolutely.
You know, this is one of the dark sides of the kind of rigidly creedal religion as David Brooks celebrates it, is that people who try to make that transition often find themselves without the sort of social resources, which is why the podcast and all of John's work and the online communities have become so important in the last few years and are going to continue to be important.
Right.
But, you know, so I'm just, you know, that's why I just keep seeing such a social piece to this. So can there be, you know, can rigorous theology also be accompanied by a community that is forgiving and supportive of faith transition and journey, right?
Exactly. And that's what
we don't have that right now in mainstream Mormonism.
And for those of you, most of you know, I've read a lot of James Fowler. Well, Beyond Stages of Faith, that's almost what his next two or three books were about. He did a book called Faithful Change. He did another one called something Becoming Christian, Becoming Adult, or something like that. And they did it when Weaving a New Vision for the Church or whatever. But all of his stuff was making adult-level maturing faith an expectation within the community, allowing doubt to come to voice and to be talked about and to have that expectation of moving beyond, you know, what he would say is basically your stage three sort of conformist thinking. And so that's what he is encouraging, and I would love to see that too, that there is this expectation. And so we have these wonderful hints from a Hubie Brown that says, you know, faith needs to serve a stewardship of doubt, but yet we have 1,000 times more voices that are like, right, what John was quoting there of it's all or nothing, it's right or wrong. And we kind of talked about that a couple of podcasts ago about you're preaching to the middle, you're shoring the base, you know, you can't give an ambiguous message to when you're trying to get the center to remain strong. So all the different things that you're right that I bring into my faith to make it feel roomy are just, they're difficult to find, and so that's what we're doing here on podcasts like this, right, and blogs and things. And I know, Brian, are you able to share a little bit a project that you and Jared are doing, or is it too premature?
Which one?
The searching?
Well, it's probably a little too early for that.
Okay, I know you've given hints here and there about it. But anyway, I know that there's more things going that need to be happening. So,
Dan, yeah. I just want to say it. One quick thing or one quick challenge to you and Joanna and Brian and anyone else who wants to do this. Anyone who talks about thick or deep religion or big religion. So maybe in the past, maybe 50 or 100 years ago, the transition from literalistic, let's just say stage three to stage five, you know, maybe there's a time where that was easier. I'm not quite sure. When I read what the Reformed Jews write, it seems like they might have had just as much of a hard time or harder than we do. But the challenge that I see, and this won't come as a surprise to you, Dan, but somebody hits stage four of Fowler's faith. They have the dark night of the soul. And, you know, they lose their literalistic binary worldview. Yes, they kind of have, you know, two options. They can try and go for the deep, broad, thick, expansive religion that you talk about, Dan, or they can sort of, you know, lose their belief. And there's a moment where they have to gain the intellectual acumen and rigor to be able to pursue that deep, thick religion.
Right.
But it's that same intellectual acumen and rigor that allows them or that propels them to start studying science, to start looking at reality, to start thinking through fully the deeper implications of the doctrines and the theologies. And I think the thing that people stumble on, Dan, isn't that they don't want to do the work, because it's a lot of work to leave a church. It's a lot of work to abandon a faith tradition. I wouldn't call these people lazy or, you know, weak. I think that what happens is they look at the underlying evidence, and they don't find religious belief credible enough to do the hard work. They don't find, and I think that's what the South Park guys were saying, is that these teachings, these doctrines, if you really look at them, they're not credible. You know, when Richard Sherlock left the church and joined Catholicism, there was this huge debate between Blake Osler and Richard Sherlock about God's, you know, post-life theology. And I don't remember the exact quote, but on the blog, somebody goes, you know, somebody writes the comment, you know, it's something like, you know, Wolverine could beat up, you know, Spider-Man. And, you know, the point that he was trying to make was, you guys are arguing about something that's stupid, that isn't credible to begin with. And I think that's the challenge I want to make to you, Dan, to you know, to Brian, Joanna, to whoever wants to argue for a more expansive religion. It's, why is the underpinning theological sort of substance credible to merit that effort?
Dan, you should be able to respond.
No, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying give your best.
Why is belief the foundation?
And I was going to say, why are you focusing on the intellectual content?
Yeah. Why is belief the fact? I mean, in Jewish community, you know, again, I will steal everything I know from the most functional religious community I know, which is, you know, my family belongs to a Reconstructionist Jewish synagogue, which is like Reform, but just a stitch different. But the thing I hear when I go to synagogue is belong, behave, believe in that order, right? Belong, choose to identify, choose to affiliate, choose to show up, choose to claim your Judaism, right? And then you behave. Then you take on some of the ethical imperatives and the behavioral imperatives, whether that's a very modern form of kosher. A lot of people eat vegan or eat organic as a new form of kosher, and then believe is last. And when I think about when we show up in Mormonism, you know, the social contract of the community is if you can perform belief and you can meet behavioral standards, then you belong, right? So, you know, that's the recipe for some kinds of trouble. You know, can we craft a relationship to our Mormon identity in which merely affiliating becomes a platform for intellectual or theological exploration, a safe, nourishing platform, you know, and does folding in some behavioral requirements as an expression of commitment to the project of community, you know, strengthen that community bond? Yes. But for now, I just hear that we're still about truth claims. We're still about foundations and belief. And I don't know if that's going to work in a post-literalistic belief religious framework.
Yeah. And Joanna, I want to believe this and I want to sell it. And I want someone to make the case. I want someone to make the case why they shouldn't look at Joseph Smith and say, charlatan, therefore, building on any foundation that starts with Joseph Smith is not a credible foundation. So I'm fine with you reversing that order. And
right.
And I think it's beautiful because I feel drawn. I feel pulled to Mormonism. I love these people. I love the church.
Right.
I love it all. But what people get stuck on is it's a weak foundation. It's not a credible foundation. Even if you dismiss the belief, you're still tied to that foundation that is not credible.
So the foundation is the historicity, the actual factuality of Joseph Smith's visions rather than your own feeling of longing. That's, well, that's the foundation for religious behavior.
That's what some people would say, right? It all begins with, yeah. And what would, right, you argue? What would you argue?
Oh, no question. It's experiential for me.
Talk more about that.
Well, I'm not saying secrets.
No.
I'm pleased to. No, okay. I mean, you know, as a child, it grows from a lifetime of experience that I don't know how to rewire my brain out of. And some of that is definitely within, you know, I think of Mormonism as a language. I don't know how to really speak any other language, but I've felt and had powerful spiritual experiences, you know, when I was young and even when I was a young adult, in the language, in the context of Mormonism. And there are just experiences I've had, spiritual experiences and dreams and feelings that I'm not going to give away for anything. Because mm-hmm. to give those away, those are an essential part of my reality as a person who's decided to be a spiritual person. And Mormonism happens to be the context in which I've experienced those things. And it's the language I'm going to continue to speak and work out all these issues in, even though I never expect to find a resolution, ever. Ever.
That's, and even though it may be not factual.
What, yeah, I'm a literature professor. Facts is like
pretty low on the totem pole. Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Consciousness, feeling, affiliation. Those are my main motivators.
Yeah, and that would be the direction I would go to, Joanna. For me, it doesn't matter. Joseph Smith's weaknesses, etc. I've experienced powerful things, and when I see Joseph Smith, instead of all the things where someone would go charlatan or fraud, I go, this guy has laid out invitations that feel real to me, and I've followed those invitations, and I've gotten results. It's like I've done my own little scientific experiments, and somehow or other, it's taken me deeper. And the more I stand back, and the more I listen to somebody like Phil McLemore, who I know that a lot of your listeners have listened to with the Eastern approach and things like that, I really see Joseph Smith as really quite powerful and even more amazing, as well as I always have to look at the scripture that was produced. And, you know, I can't go charlatan or fraud out of that.
So, where's Brian?
Yeah, I watched Brian in too. I was thinking that.
Yeah. Is it possible that there are just at least two different fundamental personality types that react to this differently? I mean, I talk to people day in, day out that, you know, like come to Stay LDS and they tell their story, and you can just see these reactions over and over. Like John mentioned, you know, it's true or it's false. You know, you really can boil it down at some point to making a decision. Now, whether you actually know the answer to that or not, but, you know, you can take a look at somebody like Joseph Smith and say, well, this is not a credible foundation. And I really understand that, even though I'm not that personality type. I'm like you guys who are the experiential, you know, if it's working for me, you know, I've had these experiences, and the fact that whether it's true or not, to me, doesn't matter as much either, but I really see how that just disturbs some people, and it's totally justified.
Yeah. Brian, is it gendered? In your experience, is it gendered in any way? I mean, no, there's a...
No. I really don't think it's a gender thing.
Uh-huh. Just temperament, huh?
But yeah, and like I don't really connect with it, but I understand intellectually why that's so important to them.
Sure.
So could that be what it is? You know, it's like once you hit this wall where you're going to have to leave this sort of more idealized, simplistic, childish, no, that's not the right word for it, but you know, a more naive view of religion, once you hit that wall and you see, gosh, there really is a lot of complexity to this, and there really isn't a lot of surety, how are you going to, you know, some people are just have to walk away because it's not true. And that has a lot of integrity to it. But where somebody like me, I start to think, well, gosh, you know, I could find problems in my marriage, so I need to leave my wife.
Exactly.
There are people at work that I really disagree with, so I need to quit my job. You know, like if I take this to the logical conclusion, I'm going to bury myself under a rock, and that'll be my life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Very interesting.
I want to make a quick reference to my latest podcast because it directly applies. A good psychologist friend of mine who's been treating LDS people for about 20 years gave a presentation at a recent Mormon Stories conference in New York. And the title of his presentation is Utility versus Validity, a Practical Approach to Faith-Related Psychological Problems. And he sets this up very nicely. Some people take a validity approach to religion. It either is true or false, and we need to find that out. Others take a utility approach. He makes a pretty good case that there is some gender associations, that females tend to take more of a utilitarian approach, and men tend to take more of a validity-based approach. So I just want to refer people to that because it's brilliant. He's an atheist who's arguing for the practicality sometimes of a validity approach, which I think is part of what you guys are arguing. But I just want to make one quick clarification, ask Joanna and Dan to just answer. So there, you know, we're never going to know for sure what happened. And I'm going to ask you about the validity of the validity approach. But there's a chance that Joseph lied about the plates, that he lied about the angel Moroni, and he lied about starting the church, or that he dreamed it up, but there was really no God there at all, and there was really no mandate to start a church. I mean, there is a certain probability that it isn't what it claims to be. And I would just ask you guys both, you know, does your commitment to the church involve the recognition of that possibility? And, you know, would you maintain your commitment to the church even if there were some way for you to sort of resolve that question and, in fact, determine that the underpinnings of the church were invalid? And my guess is that people would continue to be to participate even if they knew it was invalid. But I'm curious what you guys would say to that.
I mean, I'm more of I hold the possibility open, and a lot of times my possibility window is pretty small on certain things being literal or whatever. But I am just, the truth and the validity box is not the main box that I, you know, I judge the church through.
So you actually don't care. You don't care whether it actually happened or not.
I care, but I don't think I'll get to that. I have a sense of the universe that would allow God to communicate to Joseph Smith in a certain way. Whether he did or not, I don't know. I do see shifts in Joseph Smith's life. I see the proof in the pudding as far as some of the actions that he took that seemed consistent with somebody that had a life-changing event. And I don't need him to be perfect. I don't need him to, you know, fit into some prefab definition of what a prophet is. You know, so I guess I just don't worry about it. And all I know is I've dove into the scriptures that he produced, and those are some of the most profound experiences of my life that came out of that. Joanna?
I guess I'm kind of interested in why John is interviewing us.
Yeah, it is kind of funny. Yeah. And this is the direction my podcast interview with him went, and I totally didn't expect it either. So it's funny.
It's good. I'm just interested because, you know, I really feel like we are working out amongst ourselves and each of us from very personal places, like what is possible within the realm of Mormon affiliation and identification. Is that what you're kind of getting at, John? Like, can one identify as a Mormon, continue to find expression for and a medium for engaging with the divine through the medium of Mormonism, and yet have wide open agnosticism about just about everything except for maybe a loving God?
That is an important question. If I had to refine my question, it's this. I'm spending a lot of time with you guys trying to think about how we create a space for 21st century non-literalistic Mormons. And
right.
As I've tried to make this case, as Brian and others have tried to make, a lot of the people that I work with get stuck on this point, on there's not enough credibility to warrant the effort that Dan has taken to create an expansive religion because the fish rots from the head, would be what these people feel. And so I'm asking somebody to make the case for why these people should make the effort.
Let me refer to the chosen people because go into my default mode. You know, after the Holocaust, many, many Jews refused to believe in God anymore. Many, many Jews just said, it is impossible that there would be a God ever that would allow such a thing. You know, all this stuff about covenant was, you know, pardon my French, bullshit. Right. And, you know, and still, right, straight up rejecting the notion that there is a God, which is, talk about the fish rotting from the head.
Right.
You know, people continue to affiliate. There's even a beautiful, you know, we did Passover this last week, and we read from, when you do a Passover Seder, you read from a Haggadah, which is like a storybook or a prayer book that guides you through the service. And we use a very lefty reconstructionist, like, you know, goofy liberal Haggadah. But there's a beautiful line that allows for Jews who do not believe that God opened the Red Sea to review that incident in their own history as the courage of one person seeking freedom steps into the sea and the sea opens. Now, is it a fanciful story? Yes. Is it just as fanciful as the idea that God opened the Red Sea? Yes. Is it just as literary? Yes. But it's nourishing. I mean, and so I love what you're asking, John, because I too want to talk about, and I think Brooks, you know, the original David Brooks article gives us really good framework for thinking about if we bracket all truth claims, you know, including the idea that something should be rejected entirely because it's not true, because that's its own kind of foundationalism.
Right.
You know, what do we keep that makes this worth coming back to? Because I would say there are a lot of things. And if you don't want to affiliate, you know, God bless you. Go on your way. You know, may you have a healthy life. Truly, truly, truly. But are there some things that make this worthwhile for us that we want to return to, that do make it rigorous in the right ways, that don't levy incredibly costly social penalties on people who need to have a faith transition? You know, what can we build in that gives it traction? You know, that makes it worth coming back to.
Yeah.
You know,
I think a lot of this boils down to one question, and that is, do you like being Mormon?
Right.
Now, regardless of whatever it is about it that you like, whether you like the free casseroles after you have a baby, or you like the hymns, or you just like an excuse to go on campouts with the scouts and light things on fire, or do homemaking activities.
I'm making a list. Hymns, yeah, casseroles, yeah. Scout campouts, yes.
Yeah. Moms that want to be stay-at-home moms. And they live in a Mormon community and they want to connect with other stay-at-home moms. You know, so there's like a socialization kind of thing, shared values. I would throw the challenge out that and I'm saying this because I make a habit of constantly looking for these people. I'm so fascinated by these people that I look for them all the time. But maybe this is also because I live outside of high-density Mormon areas, but I find people all the time who don't believe parts of Mormonism. They're not articulate. They're not on podcasts. They're not writing stuff in forums. But I look for that guy who's like in the back corner of the classroom with his head down. And I make a point to go like become friends with that person and get inside their head.
Yeah.
And they don't know that they're my experiments and stuff. But no. And I really become friends because I connect with these people. But, you know, I'll ask them questions like, there was a guy I was friends with in another ward, and I knew most of his older children were inactive and had left the church, but he was a stalwart member of the church, and I became close with him, and I just asked him, I said, what do you think about this whole eternal families? Like, how do you process that your children have left the church? And he's like, you know, God's got a plan for that, and I don't really, you know, we're going to be together as a family. I don't really believe what the church says. You know, there's just got to be a way. So I find these people all the time that are making these true false. They're finding this like middle ground without big fancy words and making podcasts about it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Brian, and it's not just the quiet ones who are sitting there in the corners. I've just found like anybody, even the most vocal, active person, two questions. You know, you just go two questions deep with them, and then you see that they actually have a lot more roominess in their thinking, and they're willing to explore a little bit. So,
and yet, for reasons of social cohesion, we prioritize professions of orthodox belief, right? I know the church is true. A sentence that whatever that
it's a
means,
ritual,
that
yeah.
Means, it's a ritual, right? And yet, exactly. It places such a heavy social burden on some people of some dispositions who feel that unless they can say that, they must give up an entire social context, an entire community, an entire way of life. That's the backside of that ritual of faith.
Yeah. Kind of a really sad unintended consequence.
Right. So you like casseroles, Brian?
I love it. That's why I had six children, is to get all those free casseroles.
That's too funny. we're hitting our hour here, guys, and I think we've kind of gotten into everything. We maybe didn't kind of clearly delineate there, but I think we've kind of gotten to most of the things that I wanted to go to. I do want to ask a little bit, though, for those of you who are working especially more directly with those who are leaving. Are people leaving because the religion is asking too much of them? Are they leaving because of the, you know, the demands on time and whatnot? Or is it really, John, they just don't find it credible and worth it? In other words, if it's not the truth anymore, why should I stick with it? Is it rigorous religion, or is it really just the cognitive dissonance that are driving them away?
There's a huge array of reasons why people leave. Some people are not feeling edified and spiritually uplifted anymore. Some people feel spiritually led to go elsewhere. Some people stumble on the history. Some people struggle with the doctrine and theology. Some people struggle with the church's political culture. Some people struggle with women's issues and some of the cultural expectations. Some people just don't find the church to be relevant to their 21st century living. So it's sort of all over the map.
Well, and I figured it was, but specifically, I really wanted to know the it's too much work piece.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I agree that it's a broad spectrum, but there is definitely, I believe, a growing number of people that are just being ground out of the community by the one-upsmanship. You know, oh yeah, well you don't drink hot drinks. Well, I don't drink coffee. Well, I don't drink actually soda. Well, I don't drink anything. I don't even drink water, you know. You know, but and just all the time commitments, we're in a very time is an extremely valuable resource and commodity in our lives in this modern era. You know, people working long jobs, especially in the economy, people working multiple jobs and then being asked to do all these callings and donations. I'm running into, it feels like to me, more and more people that are just getting ground out of the system under these wheels.
Okay, so it's not just the joke of, hey, I left the church, I got a 10% raise, I get to pick my own underwear, and I have Sundays off. So it is actually, it's more than just that joke.
Yeah, but people do celebrate that too, though.
Okay.
I have a question, though. I mean, if I think about my church experience in the 70s and 80s, I think about these road shows and dance festivals and youth conferences.
Yeah, that was part of my experience too.
Yep.
Yeah.
And steak dances and regional dances. And I think of all these parents who loved the church so much that they loved being part of the youth program and spending inordinate amounts of time creating these beautiful activities for us. It's hard for me to imagine that they were less ground down than the people are today, or at least putting forth less effort. And so I have to wonder whether somehow correlation has sapped some of the vitality and the richness and the creativity that nourishes that effort, such that what used to be fulfilling, nourishing, rewarding effort that was also tiring has become stale, meaningless, rote effort that doesn't nourish. I kind of wonder that.
No, I think that's true. I think correlation could be a piece of it. I think maybe the need for two incomes, so there is, you know, less spare time. And
I
then
agree.
Just sort of the Marxist idea that if you really love what you do, you are energized by it. And that is, in other words, if it's, you know, whether I, you know, if I come home after a 10-hour energy zapping day, but I go into my hobby and I work for 6 hours, you know, rebuilding a transmission, that time flies and I'm energized after it. And so I do think the correlation piece and the idea that, you know, my creativity may not be honored, you know, from the type of work I do, because I'm going to have somebody, you know, ooh, I don't know that you brought a guitar to church, you know, that kind of thing. I do think you've hit on something there.
Can I ask a question in this vein, but take it just a slightly different channel? Brian, do you hear from young people at Stay LDS, like under 25, under 22?
It's rare. I would say most are 25 to 40 in that range.
Right. So
really
they're
not a whole lot of teenagers.
Go ahead. And certainly the costs are higher for the higher range because they've now married, because they have children and all those entanglements. Yeah.
But I'm gathering from lots of sources, you know, most of them on the grapevine, but some fairly well placed, that, you know, there may be even higher rates of loss among young adult age people, you know, in the 18 to 25 group. I've heard that that the church is having a really, really difficult retention issue, especially among young women. You know,
I've heard that too.
I wonder, you know, again, like that would not necessarily be the time constraint grinding down on them that's pressuring young women out. You know, like, you know, what insights can we collect about how to make this tradition hospitable and desirable, you know, and nourishing for young women?
Well, these aren't people that went to my site, but I can speak for my children. I have some teenage daughters, and they're really not participating anymore. And it was really just the young women's program did not connect or align with their goals. I tell this story sometimes online, but, you know, my oldest daughter, she stopped going, and she said, well, every time she went, this is how she felt. Too many times when she went, they were talking about how to prepare to be like a pure marriage partner, and so that a priesthood holder will come and find you and sweep you away, and you're just going to have children. And my daughter really wants to go to like a good, solid science and technology school and have a career. And it's not that she never wants to do that, but I hate to even say this, but she said, Dad, I'm only like 15 years old. I don't even want to think about getting married. It's creepy. Right. You know, but that was what that's all they talked about.
Right. I mean, so gender.
And she was so into it. She's so focused. You know, she'd be a leader at Young Women's, you know, the camp and everything. But it finally, it was just, it wasn't aligning with her life. You know, it wasn't providing her a context or meaning or explanations for what she was looking to do.
Yeah, and my experience growing up as a young woman in church long ago, right, was sort of different in that I felt that it was actually, compared to the kind of conservative, you know, Orange County, California social context I grew up in, I felt the church actually was a hospitable place to be a young woman who was a thinker, you know, and to be a studier and a reader. And so I wonder if gender retrenchment, you know, post-93, post-proclamation is another factor. In that kind of way of patrolling our boundaries and becoming more quote rigorous, you know, is another thing that's carrying a shadow and a body count for the church, unfortunately.
Well, that's thank you, you guys. I know my 17-year-old daughter. I'll ask her pretty much once a month or so how it's going, what kind of message she's getting. Is she's getting the marriage message and the, you know, being ready for the eternal companion stuff? And she says she does get it, but she absolutely doesn't feel anybody stirring her away from a college degree, a career if she wants it, things like that. And so in some ways it just makes me again sort of back to that earlier question that we had of, is it the message itself? Is it just the skillfulness or the personalities or the temperament of those who are communicating most directly to you? And is it possible that my daughter has heard me deconstruct so much things that I've, you know, I've said out loud as I'm coming home from church that she's just naturally doing that? A couple of podcasts ago, we talked about prophets and whatnot, and Heather Olson Beale was our person who just sort of said she grew up in that home where the dinner table conversation was just this broad-minded thing. And so that's sort of what she created. And, you know, you don't have to worry about deconstructing your kids from hearing a bad message at church because they're with you 24 hours, 7 days a week. They're only hearing that sort of stilted message, you know, 1 hour a week on occasional weeks. So anyway, those are just my little thoughts there. But hey guys, we're coming to the time where I really don't want to push it any further and have to break this up into two segments. So I appreciate you guys being on the show really a lot. I feel like here towards the end, we've been sort of a lot of what's wrong with Mormonism. What are the things that need to be fixed? Is there anything that, you know, speaks to the hope which is in your heart? Or what are the things in Mormonism that you really love and value and would hope to see ascend and be more in place than some of the things that that sometimes are driving us crazy? So whoever is ready on that with a thought, I would love to hear it. Anyone?
I'll jump in.
Okay.
I would say definitely what I love about my experience is the tight-knit community of people. Like, I can go anywhere and instantly connect and have this kind of shared cultural bond.
Yeah.
Even if I am radically different in a lot of ways and a big pain in the neck to them sometimes, I feel like it's, you know, it's family. I have been in need and gone to either the church officially or other people, and they, you know, I can't think of another community where people would come to my aid and had the opportunity likewise to, that's some of my favorite things. And as backbreaking as it is to help somebody move or, you know, just really just get in there with people and get to know them and connect on that level where you're serving people. I love the organization, you know, that's what I connect with. And there's enough there to me. Almost every possible idea has been said by somebody in Mormonism. So I feel like all I need to do is tap into the people that are helping me with my life context. Now, I sometimes go back further, you know, to these ideas of pure Mormonism or truth wherever you can find it and, you know, challenging the status quo that was in early Mormonism. I connect a lot with that. So I mean, that's a part of us, even though not maybe as popular today or as common in a lot of areas. But anyways, I just see a lot there that's possible to mine and claim as my Mormonism. So that's what I would say.
Cool. Cool.
I love that. That's beautifully said. Claim as my Mormonism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Joanna, I just want to say one other quick thing. You said something somewhere about like going a couple of times a year to synagogue, and don't anybody dare tell your husband that he's not Jewish, you know, or
oh,
something.
Oh, heck yeah.
And when you said that, I was like, wow, that is so – that I really connected with that concept.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's great. I mean, it's really been instructive and exemplary to me, you know. Would anyone tell a Jew who ate bacon that they weren't Jewish? You'd be crazy, you know. Most Jews in America are Reformed Jews who eat pork once in a while. It would be insulting. They go to synagogue a few times a year, you know. They observe life cycle rituals. They're Jewish. The end. It's not revocable. I would just love for us to have a more nourished sense of identity in our community, so that these bonds, these experiences, these feelings that mean so much to us aren't framed as being revocable if you're not creedally Orthodox. But for me, what I'd keep, lots of things. You know, prayer is a part of my post-literal Mormonism. You know, I think there's a place for prayer in the community. I haven't always been, but I am a fan of the Word of Wisdom these days, you know, as a way of kind of demonstrating a willingness to affiliate behaviorally. And then, gosh, baptism is a beautiful ritual. I just went to my nephew's baptism. It's pretty special.
Neat. John, any thoughts?
You know, as I've been trying to create these little mini Mormon stories communities all over the globe, and trying to build a community to kind of catch these people who are falling out of the church, to see if we can create a space for them so they don't have to abandon their Mormonism. You may not believe it, but I have been feeling a deep sense of love and admiration for the Prophet Joseph Smith. Because if anything, he was a community builder, and yep. if I look at what his life stood for, and stands for, you know, ignoring that maybe there were some unpleasant personality traits, but if you look at the positive, this was a man who believed in questions. He mm-hmm. believed in seeking answers. He was not afraid to challenge mores or assumptions and go to his God and say, send me truth. And right. God was willing to send him truth. He was flexible. He might have a certain version of truth one year and be willing to expand or even turn about face from that truth. And in my life, as I become a father, I respect flexibility and a willingness to amend or change if you find more truth. I think if Joseph Smith had anything, he had charisma, and people have defined charisma as a love of their fellow man. And I think Joseph had a deep love for his fellow man. I also think that he was incredibly tolerant and inclusive. Yes, his priesthood called for a one true church, exclusive authority kind of thing, but you don't get that feeling from him. You get the feeling that he said, yeah, we're true, but all you other people, you're true too. Come join us and we'll be even more true together. I feel a sense of tolerance and inclusivity from Joseph Smith. I love the heritage of song and dance that Mormonism has provided to us, mm-hmm. The choir and the stake dances and all of that. I love just this eternal sense of optimism that the Book of Mormon musical shows with all these missionaries who are smiley and optimistic and ready to tackle the world. It's almost a naive, foolish optimism, but it ends up bringing light and changing lives. I think that Mormons believe in hard work, and most of all, I think Mormons have come as close as anybody to perfecting the art of community. And I think that all stems from Joseph's example and his love of people. So I think there's an infinite amount of beauty and goodness in Mormonism that we can embrace and hold on to.
Most excellent. And I'd go with the community the stuff too that you were just sort of mentioning there, John. And I would add that piece of, I would definitely keep lay leadership for all of the problems. I think there's nothing better than having basically an unpaid ministry with jobs that switch around and chances to see life from different perspectives and to have intimate relationships that some of these callings allow you to have with people, and especially as Gene England constantly brings up, and I'm sure I've said it too many times, people are sick of it, people who you wouldn't choose to love normally, people that drive you crazy, sometimes turn in to be the most influential and the schools of love that we need the most. And so I'm certainly, for all the times I pull my hair out because of the people, I'm so grateful too that home teaching and class participation and a hallway conversation, all those things can happen to really make them wonderful friends. So that's where I would probably land.
All right, you guys convinced me. I'm staying Mormon.
Woo! John, you were foolish to think you were ever going to find a way out.
That's cool. Hey, well, this has been really good, and I'm grateful for David Brooks and writing a provocative piece that sort of gave us this chance to bounce off it. I still encourage everyone to go to New York Times and find it. It's Creed or Chaos. Back on April 21st is when it first came out. I have such amazing friends, and I'm so grateful to you, all of you guys who are on the panel tonight. You are really just the people I had to choose to associate with any day, and I feel richly blessed, and I know our listeners will be too.
Right back at you, brother. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Oh, shucks. Anyway, please, let's have a really good debate or a really good discussion on MormonMatters.org. So please go to that. Post good articles and different sorts of things, and let's really keep a good high level of discussion. I think for the most part, we've really had very good discussions on the podcast blog so far, and so we hope you'll do that. While you're there, we would love it if you would push the contribute button and help us gain a little financial support to keep this going. It does take a lot of work, but it's certainly worthy work, and we'll do it without your money, but if we're helping you at all, we'd love you to throw us $5 or $10 whenever you can. So thanks very much, everybody. Good night. Appreciate you.
Thanks, Dan. Right.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.